terms of the lecture title as the Constantinian turning point, which is a significant turning point in the life of the church, where instead of now being a persecuted minority, suddenly the church finds herself in a position of giving governance and leadership to the larger society. And whereas at the beginning of the 4th century, we will see that it was dangerous to be a Christian, at the end of the 4th century, it's now increasingly dangerous to be, quote, a pagan. And there is a complete revolution that takes place. We basically ended looking at the death of Cyprian, which comes in the middle of the 3rd century, the significant political chaos of that century, military chaos, and various other ills that the Roman world was afflicted with. In 284, there comes to power a man who initially, if you'd been living at the time, would have thought, well, he's just he's one more in a long line of individuals. He'll be here today, gone in 3 years, maximum. But in fact, the situation is quite different. Diocletian accedes to the emperorship in 284. He will reign until 305. And he does what he accomplishes for the Roman Empire, or he gives the Roman Empire the foundations to basically continue in the West for another 175 years after he steps down. It's not till 476 that Romulus Augustus in the West is deposed, the last Roman emperor. And in the East, he provides foundations which stretch nearly all the way to the end of the Middle Ages. And it's often forgotten that the Byzantine Empire, which falls to Islam finally in 1453, is basically the Eastern Roman Empire continued. Obviously, with significant changes in a variety of areas, but it basically the foundations laid by Diocletian secure stability, enough stability in the East down to the 1400s. Now, we don't want to spend enormous amount of time focused on the political issues, but something does need to be said because it bears on the religious issue on the turning point under Constantine. Diocletian engages in a number of reforms. There is military reform, for example. He realizes that the weakness of the Roman army is their dependence upon the foot soldier, the legionnaire. He begins to buttress Roman fortifications with sizable contingents of cavalry so that when there is a breakthrough on the frontier, it can be fairly easily addressed, if not repaired, but fairly easily addressed in terms of cavalry getting there as soon as there is an indication by a watchtower that there has been a barbarian incursion. So cavalry become a significant part of the Roman army. Secondly, there is governmental reform. And the issue here has to do with the fact of the peaceful transfer of power, something that the Roman world was able to achieve pretty well in the first and second centuries, fell apart completely in the third century. And he devises a system which will basically not last beyond him. But nonetheless, it does provide some stability. It gives enough stability for other reforms to kick in and provide a foundation of stability for the empire. What he does is he divides the empire into two segments, east and west. At the beginning of the course, if you remember when I talked about the linguistic division of the empire, I divided it by a line coming down along the Adriatic and then at the boot of Italy, straight down, dividing what today would be Libya, Egypt, from Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and so on. In other words, he makes an administrative reality the division of the empire that already existed linguistically. There already is a linguistic division between the Latin-speaking West, the Greek-speaking East. And what he does is he basically cements that with an administrative reform. And how to secure, first of all, the division of the empire administratively was basically coming to grips with the fact that the empire was far too big to administer. And along with the kind of governmental reform that I'm now going to talk about, he also introduced significant layers of bureaucracy. And that for two reasons. One is the significant layers of bureaucracy. That because it you simply needed more layers of administration to govern what was going on in the empire. Secondly, it was a way of making sure his person, an increasingly limited number of people had access to his person. That's the better part of wisdom. In the 3rd century, far too many emperors had been assassinated by men who shouldn't have had access to their persons. And so if you limited the number of people that you allowed into your presence, it diminished the likelihood or the possibility of assassination. And it worked. It did work. Through the 4th century, basically there are no assassinations of emperors, which is certainly completely different from the 3rd century. Now, what he did in terms of the other governmental issue was how to secure a peaceful transfer of power. And what he did was he established a title for, in another, one respect, a senior emperor in both the East and the West, whom he called an Augustus. And he occupied that position in the East and in the West. It is one of his trusty lieutenants, a man named Maximian. And so that you then have this secures a division of the empire. By the way, this is also when the empire does fall in the late 5th century, well, depending on when you date it, but in the 5th century, part of it goes back to this division. And what he has done by this division, he's really secured the possibility of one part of the empire surviving, the East, and even if the West falls. So before, it would have been most likely that if part of the empire fell, the whole construction would go down. This way, if the one section could fall without the other necessarily following suit. And then under them, he appointed a figure called a Caesar. And his Caesar was a man named Galerius. And in the West, a man named Constantius the first, sometimes known as Constantius Chlorus. And Chlorus was a nickname, meaning pale face, which obviously was something reflecting his skin color. And again, it's a Mediterranean world, olive complexion or a sun-tanned complexion would be the norm. Somebody who wasn't that way would stand out, and maybe this is the reason why Constantius the First was so called. Now, this is the father of Constantine. And these individuals, then, are described as Caesars. And the idea was, at a certain point in time, and in fact, Diocletian follows through on this, in the year 305, they would step down, go into retirement, and they would be succeeded by these two individuals. The only instance in Roman history where a living emperor actually stepped down and relinquished power to another figure. There was no other instance of that, really, in the history of the Roman Empire. Some emperors, like Marcus Aurelius, had shared power, in his case with a man named Lucius Verus, but never an instance where the emperor had stepped down completely and gone into retirement. And this series of governmental reforms gave the empire a breathing space and enabled it to survive the crisis of the 3rd century and really prolonged its life, so to speak, well into the 5th century. And in the East, where he is the emperor, secured a foundation for a millennium of existence. And then there are economic reforms. I won't go into details on this. He reminted certain coins. He founded a new standard coin, which became a standard throughout the empire. So good was this particular coinage that hordes of these coins have been found as far afield as Sri Lanka, which is Ceylon. The Romans never set foot in Ceylon. And as far north as Scandinavia, where the Vikings were, which the Romans, again, never set foot. But this coinage survived well into what we call the Dark Ages. And so there are a number of reforms then that basically gave the empire reinvigorated strength, new foundations, enabling it to surmount the crisis of the 3rd century. The one reform that is significant for us is his attempt at religious reform. And essentially what this was, it's not so much a reform as going back to the old standard policy of the destruction of the church. And in the year 303, and most scholars believe that Diocletian was an astute politician. And the only reason that he was led into adopting what would be really a suicidal program was because of his Caesar, Galerius, who had a intense loathing and hatred for the church. And there is clear evidence that Galerius hated Christianity and persuaded Diocletian to embrace a program of destroying the church. Be that as it may, or attempting to destroy the church, be that as it may, in the year 303 is launched what is known as the Great Persecution. So-called great because it lasts empire-wide in the east till 312. In the west, as we will see, it's 303 to 305 in the west. But in the east, it goes all the way to 312. And a number of edicts are passed in the winter of 303, that is February, March, April 303. The first edict is a requirement first edict actually is the arrest of all major church leaders. And a requirement for them to sacrifice. Within a very brief space of time, the Bishop of Rome is martyred. He actually is taken before Diocletian personally and martyred. The Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop of Antioch, Bishop of Alexandria, Bishop of Carthage, all of these men, significant leaders, are arrested and executed. Then there is an edict which requires the seizure of all Christian scriptures. But by the 4th century, the Roman state had acquired a level of wisdom, and that's not the word I want, a level of knowledge regarding how to fight the church in its opinion. And one is to destroy leadership, second is to destroy the scriptures, thirdly, to prevent worship. And that will be the third one, where they will destroy houses, and the church did own a few buildings that are used for worship. And the first edict to eradicate Christian leaders, so key leaders are arrested. Second edict was to seize the scriptures. Third edict was to level homes used for worship. You might ask the question, how did the Roman state know this? The Roman state did have a secret service, spies and informers. It wouldn't have been anywhere near as sophisticated as what is available today to totalitarian states, but it nonetheless would have been there. And then finally, an edict passed which required every citizen in the empire to sacrifice to the gods. The old, which is a throwback to the Decian persecution. And to demonstrate that you had done so by a certificate, a libellus. Quite different from the Decian persecution, we know of very few fallings away from the faith, or very few apostasies, or very few those who denied the faith. And it would appear that the Decian persecution caught the church to some degree by surprise, and in the intervening 50 years, there had been significant measures taken within the church to ensure that if and when persecution came again, they would not see significant men and women, numbers of men and women denying the faith. And you do not have that as an issue. What you do have as an issue, though, in North Africa, is a number of readers in the early church. And normally, in a congregation, you would have one of the deacons, or it could have been an elder, who might also be a reader. And he's the man who would read the scriptures and would normally keep the read the scriptures in the sense, read them publicly in worship, and would normally keep the scriptures in his home. And there are some examples of readers, in one case a bishop, handing the scriptures over to the Roman authorities. By this time, in the early part of the second century, third century, when this was sometimes happened or demanded by the state, certain Christians would hand over other books. You know, you might hand over, it's a book of origin. They've got no idea what it is. Here it is. By the early 4th century, the Roman state is wise to this and has some idea as to what they're looking for. And thus, there is an example of a bishop in North Africa handing over the scriptures. Well, this was regarded by some as tantamount to denying the faith. One man in particular, whose name is Donatus, will so regard it. In other words, what you have here is a repetition of the old issue. Similar issue at the time of the Decian persecution with Novatus. And Donatus will regard anybody who's handed over the scriptures as having committed apostasy. And after the persecution ends in 305, some of these individuals are restored to their churches. Donatus will argue, I will have no communion with such men. And there will be a split that takes place in North Africa, in Carthage particularly, along what is known the Donatus controversy. And the Donatus will argue for the necessity of the church being a pure church, and that anybody who has any association with a man who handed over the scriptures, either if you are in fellowship with such a person, or if you are ordained by such a person, then the Donatists would regard it as a necessity to separate from you. What we describe today as second degree separation. And the schism would be still existent all the way down to the advent of Islam. Augustine would try to rectify it and failed to do so. And after about 15 to 20 years of trying to produce some sort of reconciliation, finally will appeal to the parable in Luke where the master of the feast, having sent out the summons to come to the feast, says when he's told there's still room, go out and compel them to come in. And Augustine will see that text as justifying the use of state force to compel the Donatists to attend the churches in communion with Augustine, which is a faithful move for the Middle Ages, very faithful, as one could expect. So there is a split. It has overtones of the Donatist controversy North Africa. Overtones of the Decian, the controversy between Cyprian and the Novatians in the Decian persecution. In the East, there is also a split. It's known as the Meletian schism. And it takes place between two men, Peter of Alexandria, and an elder in the Church of Alexandria, Meletius. Sometimes it's an M-E-L-E, sometimes it's like that, or the I. And early on in the persecution, Meletius and Peter were both arrested, and they were talking about the issue in the prison cell of how they would deal with those who had denied the faith during the persecution. There were not many, but some. And then who wanted, after the persecution was over, even that is very interesting. They assume that the church will survive, which is a very common conviction in this early centuries, that the attempts by the Roman state to destroy the church were not going to succeed. And they were talking then about what would they do if people came to them asking to be readmitted to fellowship. Well, Peter said, it's obvious we must do like our Lord did with the Apostle Peter and forgive where there is genuine and sincere repentance and restoration being worked out. Meletius adopted the same view as Novatus 50 years earlier, said there's no way. We've been through the fire. These people have committed the unforgivable sin. And the quarrel between them grew so intense that one of them, and I forget which one, got up and drew a line in the dust in the prison cell floor and said to the other brothers who were in the prison cell, those on my side, on this side of the line, and those on the other side, you go over there with him. And the consequence was there was a split right in the prison cell. Both men died as martyrs, but the split persisted. And it has great significance for Athanasius, because Athanasius is the second bishop after Peter. Peter was succeeded by Alexander of Alexandria. Athanasius succeeded Alexander of Alexandria. The Meletians hate him. Even though the Meletians are committed Trinitarians, they so hate Athanasius that they are willing to side with the Arians to oppose him. And as we'll see, the Arians are heretics, theologically. And sometimes it's said politics make strange bedfellows. Sometimes religious issues make strange bedfellows, too. And so this has significance. At the height of the persecution, Diocletian suddenly says, that's it, I'm retiring. And Maximian, he had chosen Maximian because the man was fervently loyal to him. And he'd been one of his key lieutenants during his time as a military man. Diocletian was a military man who'd risen all the way up through the ranks to become emperor. And Maximian didn't really want to step down, but when Diocletian said, you're going too, he had no alternative. And he went kicking and screaming. Diocletian, we're told, spent the last of his life growing cabbages in a huge palace he built on the shores of the Adriatic called the place called Split, spelt in English Split, S-P-L-I-T. I have a friend who served as a missionary in Bosnia, and apparently his palace is still there, at least part of the ruins of it. And he said up until quite recently, you could actually dive down in the water. It's right on the coast. Dive down the water and pick up, there were Roman coins and pottery items in the water until the Bosnians realized they could make some money out of this. And now they've kind of cordoned the whole area off and prevented access, easy access to it. So Diocletian then steps out of the limelight, ends his life growing vegetables, cabbages we're told, and Galerius becomes the emperor. He will appoint another Caesar. And there is then a peaceful transfer of power. Constantius becomes the emperor, the Augustus. He immediately halts the persecution. And why he does that, we'll talk about in a minute. Galerius does not. And so Galerius keeps the persecution going. Eusebius of Caesarea, who is one of our key sources for all of this, who there have been significant discussions about his reliability as a historian. By and large, he is a fairly reliable historian. And that comes actually from a man named Timothy Barnes. And I'm going to mention this book again called Constantine and Eusebius. And I'm not sure if it's upstairs. Barnes changed my whole perspective on Constantine. When I first started teaching this course, I had a whole different view of Constantine. And then about 3 years into the course, the book appeared, I read it, and I realized that Barnes had a fairly watertight case for his argument, which I'll relate in a minute, and my whole position on Constantine did a 180-degree turn. And a lot of some of Barnes's case revolves around the reliability of Eusebius as a historian. Eusebius is an eyewitness to some of this. And he talks about Christians being martyred from morning, daybreak, till sundown. And they weren't throwing them in the arena. They basically were just simply chopping off heads, and they were doing it in shifts. That's how many. We're looking at tens of thousands of martyrs in the Eastern Roman Empire over the space of about 9 years. And if that figure seems large to you, you need to know that in parts of Asia Minor and parts of Egypt, some of the villages and towns were anywhere between 80 to 90% Christian. We know that from census records that have survived, from names that are given to children. Pagans are not going to be giving biblical names. Nor are they going to be giving names like Constantius gave to one of his daughters when he called her Anastasia. That is not a pagan name. That means resurrection. And pagans did not believe in resurrection. Which, and we'll get to this in a minute, raises questions about where did he stand? Why did he immediately stop the persecution as soon as he becomes the Augustus? Why did he call his daughter Anastasia? Anyway. In 311, Galerius finds himself, though, stricken with cancer. And there are ironies. When I was much younger, I used to read a fair amount of fiction. I rarely read fiction today. Maybe it's a liability. I don't know. Part of the reason being is history is a lot more fascinating than any sort of fictional account. At the height of the persecution, Galerius gets struck with cancer. He stops the persecution, asks the church to pray for his healing. And, I mean, it's one of these remarkable ironies of history. He dies in 312. I've never probed contemporary Christian accounts to find out whether or not they prayed for him. There is a book written by a man named Lactantius with the interesting title of Deaths of the Persecutors. And in which he details how God judges the various persecutors historically in history. So did the church pray for Galerius' healing? I don't know. But it's one of these ironies of history. Here's the man who's been brutalizing the church. He suddenly finds himself dying and stops the persecution and asks for prayer. Not too dissimilar in the Second World War, Stalin, realizing when the Nazis invaded Germany in 1941, realizing the great need of the Orthodox Church to stand, get the people rallied to the great cause of defending Mother Russia, stopped the persecution of the Orthodox churches and other Christian churches and asked them to rally the people to defend Mother Russia. As soon as the war was over, the war was won, started the persecution again, and various figures, like men like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who had spoken out during that lull period, might be marked down and they were arrested and so on. The big question, though, surrounds this man, Constantius. And what I'd like to do then is look a little bit about him and then move on to looking at Constantine.